The following program contains the opinions of the host, guests, and call-in participants. These do not necessarily represent the views of this show's distributors or sponsors. This program may contain obscene, profane, or otherwise objectionable language. Viewer discretion is advised. Yes, coming to you cordless, everybody, from Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's 11 p.m. on the East Coast of the United States. It's 8 p.m. on the West Coast, 2 o'clock in the afternoon at the Sydney Opera House, and 10 p.m. Central Time, where I'm sitting here in Ilhan Omar's district in Northeast Minneapolis. It's Monday, March 25th, 2024, and this is our 100th show. We made it. Who would have thunk it? My God, unbelievable. Anyway, we got a big show for you tonight. You know we do. Big shoe, you know. Murray Sabrin is our guest. I asked him partly because he was a guest on our very first show. He's an economist. He comes on, he talks about the economy because you folks don't know shit about it because nobody does. Nobody understands it. How come we're not teaching this in high school? It's really crazy. Nobody knows anything about money. Most capitalist society on the planet, we don't know shit about money. You know, it's unbelievable. So also, we are going to be playing the new music video from the band Gun Hill Road, this legendary 60s rock band. They've been around for literally like 55 years, and they're doing music videos now. And the amazing thing is they get played mostly on talk radio because most of their music is now issue-oriented. This song's called Damn Scammers, Get Off My Phone. Now, normally, well, one of the reasons we're playing this is because Michael Harrison, an old friend of ours, a publisher of Talkers Magazine, he's a member of this band. Michael's not going to be on tonight because he had surgery on Thursday. So we're hoping our best wishes to him. Hope he's getting better. But we're going to play the video at some point, but right before Murray's interview, I think, because I'm really prepared. I don't know if you guys noticed, but yeah. So that, okay, let me give you a schedule of what's going on here in the next few days. Tomorrow night, Bruce Rapuano, neuroscientist and alien abductee, is joining us. He wrote a book called Dominion Lost. It's a fascinating book. It's a little dense on the science side, but still well worth the trouble. I mean, you know, I'm just curious. I am obsessively curious to the point where it's a sickness, you know. So I loved the book. I loved it. The science part, the book's basically in two parts. It's about his personal experiences getting abducted by aliens, and then it's about his conjectures as a scientist and based on what he knew literally from firsthand observation of how these things, that being flying saucers, how they fly. So, and that part is, I found that part absolutely fascinating. And kudos to him. I mean, this sounds like a backhanded compliment, but it's not. He made the subject about as simple as you can make it, even though he's talking about quantum physics. But there's no formulas or anything like that. So it's like, you know, there's no math in it. You know, I'm sure you'd enjoy the part where he talks about his abductions. I don't know if you'd enjoy the science part, but I loved it. I highly recommend the book. And we're looking forward to talking to him. Wednesday, we're taking the night off. Thursday, our old friend Jazz Shaw from Salem Media, he writes about conservative politics and UFOs for Salem Media, and he's coming on. We haven't talked to him in about 6-8 weeks. We got a zillion questions for him. That's always interesting. You know, it's interesting for me. I book the guests. What can I tell you? I book the people I like, you know, that I think are interesting. I'm hoping that you think it's interesting too. You know, I can't guarantee that, but, you know, I hope you do. So, that's Thursday. We don't do Fridays here. Monday, it's our month in review panel. That would be Jim Conaway, Don Zorro, and Larry Newman, and we shoot the shit for an hour because we're old men and we're not meeting at the coffee shop, I guess. I don't know. You know, it's like, but we're going to talk about the news from the last month, And then we're taking the rest of this week off to that week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, the 2nd through the 4th of April. Now, here's the reason we're doing that. And that is, okay, 100th show, you know, we sent out a press release, you know, I got some calls here. It's kind of nice for the people calling. We're upgrading our studio. We're putting in a new camera and new lights. And so it's going to take us a few days to tune, especially the lights. Those of you who've been watching the show from the beginning, you know, I spent 2-3 weeks tuning the lights before we started in August. And we still spent a month after that fucking around with them. And so it's just unbelievable. Now, finally, we got it. And you're thinking, well, Jim, why are you changing? Well, the thing is, I understand the process a lot better now. So I bought better cameras and better lights, you know, and we're installing them. It's going to take me a few days to tune them up. It is. This is what I'm trying to avoid. I don't want to work my makeup on camera now because this is a static shot. We got one camera here. I'm not moving around a lot. And also this camera, the autofocus is a lot better. The colors are a lot better. I should be able to get by without wearing makeup. I don't want to wear makeup. I've done television before, like real television, you know, not like this, not fake television. But the single biggest pain in the ass about the whole thing is wearing makeup. Maybe that's because I'm a guy. I'm not used to wearing makeup. I don't like it. I just don't like it. I don't like the way it feels. I know that it makes you look better on camera. I understand that. And that's kind of the primary difference between radio and television. In radio, you put up a bunch of mics. Nobody gives a shit about what anything looks like. And because of that, radio seems like a real, real, real experience. Television, you have to make it fake to make it look real. I mean, it's really weird. You know, if you saw me in my television makeup, you know, I look hideous. It's like the old thing from Seinfeld. Like Kramer says, Jerry, I'm hideous. Yeah, I am. You know, but on camera, I look great, you know. I'm sure you say the same thing about everybody at Fox News and MSNBC, too. They put their makeup on, and if you saw them off camera with the makeup on, they look bizarre. They look like clowns. And, of course, the people at MSNBC, they are clowns. And I have some news about that I'm going to get to in a second. But, yeah, I don't want to wear makeup. I just don't. So we're gonna tune this up. I mean, so far, so good, you know. Now I'm going to shout out to my hairstylist, Brittany Shears. Cut my hair on Saturday. Makes me look pretty. I'm way prettier. You know, you may think, well, I don't look that pretty, but Jim, you should see me off camera. Oh, man. No, she doesn't have a lot to work with. So our thanks out to go out to her. We're putting up a new end card this coming week, too, and we're giving her a little credit because she deserves it because, my God, like, you know, trying to make this look good. Holy shit. All right. So we're taking calls all night long. Now, I shouldn't say that. I got to qualify that. We did Murray's interview this afternoon. Now, normally he comes on live, but he didn't today. One of the reasons is because he gave a very important speech at the Mises Institute, which is an economics forum at Auburn University on Saturday night. Saturday morning. Saturday morning. So this is a big deal for him. Kudos to him. You know, he's one of the foremost economists in the United States. We're lucky to have him on. And I have to say, I really do have to say this. At 100 shows, when it comes to guests, we're batting way beyond our pay grade. I mean, I don't know why some of these people come on. I'm really glad they do. I ask them. Very few people that I invite on the show say no. I'm really quite shocked. I don't know if that's because word gets out that we treat people well. I don't know. I really don't know. But, yeah, we've had very, very good luck getting guests. So, and also, now, this wasn't on the rundown because it's 3 weeks from now. But on April 22nd, we have Kathleen Martin coming on. She's the niece of Betty Hill, of Betty and Barney Hill fame, but from 1961, basically the first documented alien abduction, at least in the United States. Not really, but more or less. It was the first one to get a lot of attention. They didn't want any attention, Betty and Barney Hill. As a matter of fact, the reason it got attention is because in their psychiatrist's office, a secretary leaked the story to the press in Boston, and they weren't looking for publicity at all. As a matter of fact, they hated it, but it happened. The whole thing blew up. There was some corroborating physical evidence about the fact they were abducted. There were weird stains on Betty's torn dress and weird marks on their car, And the really weird thing, and we'll talk with Betty about this too, the thing that Stan Friedman says was the smoking gun of ufology, and that is Betty asked the aliens where they were from, and they showed her a map. And she drew the map, and it turned out that that map was real and accurate, except in 1961, nobody knew where the Zeta Reticuli star complex was. And the fact that she knew and nobody else on the planet knew, Stan Friedman said, that's proof that she was abducted. And I got to admit, I agree. I don't think you can't argue with it. That's what I think. Even though there's all sorts of people who have been tried to discount the story, I don't think they can. We have a call here, and I think I know who this is. I recognize the phone number. Hi, is this Jeff?
It is. Congratulations.
Hey, Jeff Meyer, our sponsor, publisher and CEO of Conk News. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing well. 100 shows.
100 shows. I know. Who would have freaking thought it, you know? Unbelievable.
Yeah, I was trying to remember, because you kind of look like you could be 100, but then I'm like, no, his mom's 100. It's got to be 100 shows.
Yes, that's right. Yes, mother is 100. I am not. Yeah, that's true. That's true. What's going on in Conk World?
There's so much.
You sound tired, man. Are you?
No, I'd been reading some stuff. Jazz Shaw has had some really good stuff that makes it onto Conk in the last couple of weeks. And
yes, he has.
Just a lot
I know.
Of stuff, a lot of weird news going on out there.
I know. He's coming on Thursday. I'm looking forward to talking to him. But I'm glad you brought that up. Those guys, I gotta admit, I really love Hot Air. I really do. It's like those people, they know what they're doing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. They report some good stuff that you won't find anywhere else.
Right. That's right. That's right. And Conk, of course, Conk runs it. You know. And matter of fact, while you're on the hey. I have your commercial queued up. Let's just do it right now. Here's your front page. Are you watching, Jeff?
I am not. I'm on my cell.
Okay. That's okay. Yeah. So here's your front page of Conk News. Now this is in real time and Conk is our sponsor. And so this updates every 3 hours, every single day, 8 times a day. And, let me see, what do we got here in the second, types a little small for me on my monitor. President Trump posts Bible verses and prayers to Truth Social. And, of course, he did because he made $4 billion today. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you heard this, Jeff, but supposedly the sale of Truth Social is going to put him among the top 500 richest people on Earth.
Yeah. It's all going to work out, isn't it?
Yes, it does seem that way, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah,
but the New York appellate court said, $450 million, let's bring her down to $176 million.
And if you stop and think about it, though, considering the quote-unquote crime, that's still terrible, outrageous, but it's way better than what it was, you know?
Yeah, well, and the thing is, the ridiculousness is coming to the surface. Look at NBC News. Their employees are bitching about another employee hire.
Yeah.
And no one's saying anything about, like, discrimination. They're going to implode on their own, and they're all afraid of some woman named Ronna McDaniels. Crazy.
I know. There's another thing that happened today. I was gonna, and this was on my rundown, too, about the fact that they cut Donald Trump off because they said he said an obvious falsehood that Biden was coordinating all these court things behind the scenes. And I'm thinking, how do they know that's false? They're not giving them any, you know, it's like, all right, so, you know, Trump has an opinion and that's fine, but they're saying, no, it's a fact. Biden did not do this. They don't know that. It's bullshit.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's just like me talking, being an election denier. I have evidence that they screwed with the 2020 election, but I don't have any proof. And I've always admitted it. I don't have any proof. I don't. They don't have any proof that he's not doing it, and they said so anyway. You know, what the hell?
Right.
Just really pisses me off. Anyway, Conk is at conk.com, conk.com. This is a completely free service, so The pictures are from the articles. The headlines are not rewritten. And you click on one of these things, there's no interstitial pages. You go directly to the story. They get news from 75 different news sources every 3 hours. You if you're a news junkie, I keep saying this is a sexual experience, but it is. It is for me because I'm easy.
Yeah, you get to stay on at one site and just bounce around to all the freshest articles. So
yeah, and you can spend 2-3 hours going through this. I mean, you know, and then it changes all three. Most of it changes every 3 hours. All of the old news gets pushed to the bottom. But yeah,
correct. Yep, it just rolls just like news is a commodity. So it's got a born on date that goes bad and then rolls to the bottom.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Jeff, thanks for calling in. I really appreciate it.
You got it. Thank you, Jim. Congratulations.
Hey,
we'll
thank
talk
you.
To you next week.
Thanks for sponsoring us. Yeah, and you'll be on. Yeah, you're coming on. Yeah, you'll be on in 2 weeks, right?
2 weeks. Awesome.
Yeah, okay. You take care, man.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yep. We'll see you soon. Bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.
That's Jeff Meyer. He's the CEO and publisher of Pronk News, our sponsor. That's really nice for him to call in. Really nice. Really appreciate it. So, and I'm going to play you something else here, too. Our longtime caller, David from San Francisco, sent us a voicemail today. Now, you could do this, too, and I was going to get around to telling you this. This is how you call into the show. We were just talking about this when Jeff called. Okay, there's three ways. First of all, you can call in with your webcam. We're the first talk show in America. I'm not kidding. I didn't make this up. Talkers Magazine said this. We're the first talk show in America that lets people call in with a video, with their cameras. So what you do is you go to, you see this URL right down the bottom of the screen here? Gemini.com/call. You go to that webpage. I know this sounds weird. I know, because you usually don't use the web to call in to send your webcam. But trust me, this works really slick. You go to that webpage. There's a big blue button at the top of the screen. You press that. You end up in a preview screen. You get to check your camera and mic. And then you hit join at the bottom, and you're in the queue. It's super simple. It's easier than making a FaceTime call. I'm not kidding. It really is. The other way you can call in is the way Jeff just did. You can call in via audio, and that's right here. That number is 563-999-3435. You point your cell phone to that number, and you end up in a queue here, and that's just like Jeff did. It was audio only. And then we can send us a text in real time to 408-458-5088, and I get those on the screen off to my left here. Also, and this is what happened this afternoon, this is what David did, you can call, well, first of all, we'll get those texts 24/7, but I do get them, I check them while we're on in real time, while we're on the air, and you can call that number and leave a voicemail message, 30 seconds, and this is what David did, and I'm going to play his, he's a longtime caller here, it goes back to when I did podcasts and radio shows for Pronk News, and so, We're gonna put his here's his.
Hi Jim, this is David from San Francisco. I won't be able to call you tonight live because I'm not available, but I wanted to send you this message. Congratulations on the 100th show, and thank you for inviting me also. And I hope all is well. And I remember the days on Rumble, because I only watch you on Rumble. You had 13 followers. Now you have over 1,300. So that's wonderful, wonderful growth. Again, I hope is well. I hope you do good, and it's my pleasure to listen to you and keep up all the good work. Thank you very much, Jim. Have a good show. Bye-bye.
Thank you, David. That was very kind of you. Really appreciate it. And actually, I don't know how you figure this. We actually have 2,000 followers on Rumble, but 1,300 are following our channel page. And 700 are following my personal profile. The only thing I do in Rumble is this show. So the weird thing is I can't even figure out how you follow a person on Rumble, but people know how to do it. I can't figure it out. I mean, it's easy to follow a channel. You just go to the channel and hit the follow button. But I can't figure out how you, my profile is not, I don't see how you follow it. But anyway, people know how to do that. So I say we have 2,000 followers, and I think that's probably accurate. So people are following different things, but it's all the same. So that's what we got going on here. So thanks for David for calling. Really appreciate that. So, yeah, you can call in anytime tonight. We're going to be doing a playing Murray's interview in about a half an hour. Then we got a C block here. If you've ever watched the show before, that's what it's basically in three parts. I do like a monologue. I talk, you know, usually about news, pretty much about news. We have a guest. Usually it's an interview. It is an interview, but I mean, usually it's either live or on tape because we're so late at night, especially on the East Coast. People don't want to come on that late, so I give people the option of a tape in the afternoon. And then we do basically a C block where I talk about weird shit. And we have another call. Hold on. Hello, who's this?
Oh, hey there, Jim. Congratulations on show number 100.
Is this Tim Conaway?
This is Tim Conaway calling in. Say congratulations on this show. And
thank you.
And,
and talking to you, I get tingling in my loins, kind of.
Well, that's, I have that effect on people, but it's not the ones I want to, but.
How are you doing, Mr. Conaway? How's things?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. I just want, listeners to know that I knew Jim way back when he did his first show. And
yeah.
For all this time, it hasn't changed his personality one bit.
No, it's still a stupid jackass. Yeah, that was a good 4 years ago, I think, that we started doing this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've been a long time. Always glad to be part of it. Always a lot of fun. And
well, you're coming
on
next Monday, right?
That is true. That be on for the month end wrap up,
right?
And or something. It's April Fools, so we don't know exactly what we'll be doing.
That's right. I'm sure. Yes, I'm sure some sort of commotion will occur. I'm sure it will. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you know, you have an interesting hobby. You're a woodworker.
Right. Yeah. And
you like that, right?
Yeah, I'm just received a new Rockler catalog in the mail today, and so I'll go through that and drool over various tools and accessories and probably go spend money on some of them.
Isn't it amazing as you get older, and you and I are almost the exact same age, how you get older and all the what stuff is sexy?
Yeah. Yes,
I know.
Where you spend your afternoon, it's, at the local hardware store, or in your case, I know it's the local electronics store.
Yeah, yeah. And, I don't know. Are you watching the show right now?
No, I'm sitting here. I'm suffering from COL, which, you know, is cat on lap.
Yeah.
I have
The reason I mentioned this is before you called in, I was talking about the fact that on our week off, we're changing the camera and lights here in our studio. And because you're right, because I was drooling over equipment.
Yeah.
That's the reason. So,
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, can easy to do. That's another area. Photography is another area that I spend money on. But, I also want, to remind people this is the only podcast that I know of, not even one of the few, but the only podcast where you can hear about UFOs. One night you can get an interview with a nationally renowned economist, and another night you can get an interview with an AI expert. Covers a lot of ground and always interesting people.
Yeah, I'm thinking about doing OnlyFans night. We're going to get some strippers on. Why not? going for broke. Hey, I know who's watching this. I don't think a lot of women are watching this, but whatever.
Might not be, but it could be.
Yeah,
but,
yeah. Besides, doesn't everybody enjoy a good stripper?
Well, yeah. Everybody.
Well, not children.
And, well, no. But,
what?
Know,
yeah,
they,
no. I put you on the spot. Sorry about that.
Well, we're all adults on the at the late night entertainment.
Yeah, that's true. We are. And besides, you know, you go on with Don Zorro, so you know, there's nothing more obscene than that. So. Hey Tim,
and
thanks for calling. I really appreciate
book.
It. What did
oh,
you
sure.
say?
Oh, sure. And like I said, the Don Zorro joke book. You know, is adult
oh,
friendly.
Yes. Where does he get that stuff? Holy shit!
That's
my God.
Wellspring. But yeah, I just wanted to congratulate you and wish you, you know, many hundreds more of these shows. And
thank
everybody
you.
Keep tuning in.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Tim. I appreciate your involvement and your support. I really do. Thank you very much.
Oh,
thank you.
You bet.
So we'll see you on Monday, on Monday's show.
Yeah.
I already promoted it. So.
Yeah, we will be there, and we will recap the month's. This past month's events, and as only we can.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All right, Tim, you have a nice evening, okay?
All right. Take care, Jim.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
That's Tim Conaway. He's part of our Month in Review panel. And, yeah, so Tim and I go back a long way. I mean, I did about... you know, my recent work history is I was the editor-in-chief of Conk News, our sponsor, 3 years before I started this. And in that three-year time at Conk News, we did about 400 radio shows and podcasts, about two every week, roughly. And so, yeah, so Tim's goes back with me a long way, and I appreciate this. And he's got a really interesting history, and I tease him about this, but this is really true. Well, he edited over the course of his career as a journalist. He edited about over a dozen magazines. But his claim to fame, and this is legit, I'm not making this up, he was the executive editor of Hustler magazine during the 80s and 90s at the time of the height of its popularity. So that's what he did, and that basically made his career. I know you're probably thinking, well, it's Hustler, but still, that magazine flourished under his leadership. And that basically set his career up for him. And he was the editor of Muscle and Fitness, all sorts of, I mean, about a dozen different magazines after that. So over a 40-year career. So, I mean, the guy's really accomplished. And he was talking about photography. I know his little secret is that he's an absolutely excellent live television director because he's directed several shows I've done. So that's another way I know him, too. Anyway, yeah, so, I mean... Just a very, very talented man. I'm lucky to know him. I know a lot of very talented people, and I make fun of Don Zorro, but Don Zorro's a talented guy too. And then Larry Newman's part of that. He's the fourth guy in the foursome, the Month in Review panel. So Larry is both a bail bondsman by profession and also a certified, it sounds like I'm going to say certified crazy. No, he's a certified Bigfoot investigator. For the Bigfoot Field Research Organization, which is like the MUFON of Bigfoot in the United States. And he got started on that. This is really, I find this fascinating. They asked him to do it because of his police background. He was a police investigator. And he did not believe in Bigfoot. But he said, well, you know, that's not the point here. We're actually investigating and trying to prove, you know, trying to find evidence that Bigfoot is real. So he said, I don't have to believe in this or not. He said, until one night in the Ozarks, in the middle of the night, he said he watched a family of Bigfoot, a mama bear, mama Bigfoot, papa Bigfoot, and a little baby Bigfoot through an infrared camera for an hour. He did not see them with his naked eyes because it was pitch dark. But he watched them through an infrared camera for an hour, and he said after that he was basically sold on the fact Bigfoot is real. So he's going to be coming on Monday too. So, and he comes on, sometimes he does come on separately, and we talk about this stuff too. You know, he's just a really fascinating guy. I mean, first of all, being in law enforcement, he has, as you might imagine, he has very, very strong feelings about especially what's going on right now in law enforcement in the United States, which is terrible. We're treating policemen like shit. I mean, I don't have to tell you. We just do. And then all the liberal cities wonder, well, why are all the policemen retiring? It's like, why are they quitting? Oh, geez, I wonder why. You treat them like crap. It's like, I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, I don't understand the stupidity that's going on in America right now. Now, Jeff Meyer touched on this, and this is on my rundown for tonight. Okay, so Trump had his bond today reduced from $540 to $175 million. I just want to point out that $175 million is still a shitload ton of money, you know, and this is for something, a crime where there was no victim. That's the other thing. There's no victim to this supposed fraud. Nobody lost any money. Nobody got screwed. Hell, the banks took the stand in his trial and said, oh, we'd love to do business with Donald Trump again. It's fantastic. They've never lost a dime doing business with him, you know. And so he got fined $540 million. And the really weird thing is, supposedly, New York State is the only state in the union where you have to post the bond before you can file an appeal. This was not done for Donald Trump. This has been this way for quite a while. So to appeal your case, you have to post the bond ahead of time. So he supposedly had to come up with $540 million just to file an appeal. So they got around that, and the deadline was today, but they got around that by appealing to a federal court that this was it was unconstitutional, and it is. And the court agreed. Excuse me. It basically goes under the Eighth Amendment of excessive fines. The Eighth Amendment says you cannot charge somebody an excessive fine. The Eighth Amendment is the same amendment that talks about cruel and unusual punishment, which everyone's, you know, familiar with that phrase. But it's actually in the Eighth Amendment, and it explicitly says in the Eighth Amendment you can't charge somebody an I think the word's an excessive fine. Now, you have no victim in this supposed case, and usually the fine is set by how much, as a penalty based on how much you screwed people out of. So technically, since nobody got screwed, the fine should have been zero. You got that? All right, so this is nuts. So the thing is, so they went to federal court today, and they got the fine reduced. Now Trump says, I've been following this. I'm assuming he's telling the truth there. Trump says this is the fifth time in a row that Engeron, the judge, has been overruled in this case. It's probably going to get thrown out altogether. But he has to post the fine just to go to appeals court, you know? So, and this is the other thing. I mean, it's so obviously dirty. Letitia James actually campaigned on getting rid of Trump. Engeron valued Margaret Mar-a-Lago at $18 million until Trump had to come up with the fine. And then he said, well, you could sell Margaret Mar-a-Lago. You could sell it for $400 or $500 million. And that's actually way under its value. I mean, Trump says it's valued at about $1.5-1.6 billion. I'm guessing on the market, it probably get about $1 billion, but it would get $1 billion, you know? And these people are crazy. So Trump gives an impromptu, and you're thinking, well, Jim, you're on a tear here about the justice system. Actually, no. This is all leading up to, I'm actually talking about the media here, because what happened is after this Trump left court and the appellate court ruled that the fine was reduced, he gave essentially an impromptu press conference on the at 40 Wall Street, a building he owns. It's actually a very famous building that is called the Trump Building. Of course it is. He named it, you know. But 40 Wall Street is a very famous building. He owns it. And so he's giving in the lobby there. He's giving an impromptu press conference. And he's talking about the fact that the Biden administration is coordinating all of these lawsuits and these trials that he's going through, that this was arranged in advance. And there is some evidence to indicate Nathan Wade, Fannie Willis's lover, or Fawny, or whatever the hell her name is, the guy she hired, who she was stuffing and paying an exorbitant fee, and then they had to fire her. They had to fire him because of the relationship. Receipts, literal receipts, of him going to the White House numerous times before the trial started. And normally, this person would not have any business at the White House. Normally, they wouldn't. But here's the amazing thing. So MSNBC is covering this impromptu press conference, and they cut it off because they he started talking about Biden coordinating all these trials, because and the anchor on CNN said this is an obvious falsehood and Mr. Trump is lying. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, no, it's not. It's not. It may be a falsehood, but it's not obvious. You haven't given us any evidence that this is wrong. You just made an assumption that he's lying. And to a reasonable person, it appears that he isn't. You know, I mean, yeah, maybe that isn't true. I'm not saying it is. I don't have any evidence either. But a reasonable person could conclude that some of this is being coordinated. Okay, you don't, you know, Trump doesn't have any proof either. Probably, I don't know, maybe he knows from behind the scenes, but he can't prove it. I don't know. But this guy on MSNBC, he doesn't have any proof that it isn't. I mean, and this goes to my thing. You know, I've been talking about this for 3 freaking years about the fact, you know, I'm an election denier. You know, I actually think there was some cheating in the 2020 election. And I've said I don't have any proof. I don't. I've always said that. I always qualified this. I have no proof at all. But I have evidence. And my evidence is unusual, but it's particular to my personal experience. I've been in the entertainment business most of my life. And because of that, I've dealt with crowds and audiences. So this is what happened in 2020. I've said this before, but I'm going to repeat this because it's really pertinent to what's going on here with this MSNBC thing. In 2020, other than one campaign stop that Biden made 5 days before the election in Pennsylvania, where he drew 900 people, that entire campaign, all of 2020, Joe Biden never drew more than 200 people to any campaign event. And it usually was way less than that. It was like 100. It was so, and this sounds counterintuitive, but bear with me here. It was so little that people couldn't be counted because in many instances, the press and his staff were just, there were just as many people there as the public. So you got this. Well, I don't know how many events they did, 50, 70, I have no idea. He didn't draw, with one exception, he didn't draw more than 200 people at any event. Now, conversely, Trump, and this is not an exaggeration, drew an average of 20,000 people to every campaign event he did, which, you know, he calls them rallies, and they are rallies because so many people showed up, and they're still rallies, you know? So my thing is, they're saying that Biden got 81 million votes, but to my mind, that doesn't rectify at all with the number of people that showed up to see him. That should be that, you know, and the thing is, and I know this, and people say, and even my friend Tim Conaway just called, you know, he talks about this, about the fact that he's an election judge here in Minnesota. He says, Jim, you have to understand, people didn't vote for Biden. They voted against Trump. But my response to that is, everybody? 97% of the people voted against Trump? Because if you go by this, and this is still going on. We got a call here. I'm going to take this. This number I do not recognize. Hello, who's this?
Hello, am I on air? Hey, Dimitri.
Oh, Dimitri. My God. Oh, it's President Vladimir Putin. Holy shit. This is fantastic.
I call to wish you 100-year anniversary of your radio show.
Yes, 100
and
years.
I want you to call me when I celebrate my 100-year rule over Soviet Russia.
And you will, won't you? That's oh my God!
Congratulations. President, that's a long President, time to be having radio show.
Thank you, President Putin. I really appreciate it. What's it like on your end? What are you doing lately?
No. I'm very busy right now. I just want to call this evening, all about you and all about your accomplishment over 100 years.
Oh, man. Yeah, 100 years. Yeah, wow. That's fantastic. That's terrific. Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't, you know, unlike you, I don't have any, you know, tanks or any of that sort of stuff, but, you know. I got my damn good looks.
I have a question for you though. To what?
Yes.
To what do you attribute to your accomplishment of such a great feat?
Just sticking to it. It's just plowing forward, man. Four shows a week, you know. It's like we're just going on and on, you know. But we're lucky
we have people like you who call in,
you know. Not everybody gets a call.
We do have what you call a daily grind in Russia. Yes, it's
yes. Right, right, yeah. No, we, you know, we're lucky. You know, you're not calling into the Today Show, you know. You're calling here, so, you know. By the way.
Special friend, Dmitry. I just want to call, wish you a happy anniversary and success on your radio program and, you know, congratulations.
I appreciate that, President Putin. Now, we have to have another interview with you again where you know, maybe you have another different lunchbox this time.
Oh, yes. There's no more Putin. It's,
great.
Maybe
no
just,
Putin.
And next time it will be sack of potatoes.
Yes, it will, won't it?
I must go. I have lots to do in country, lots of Uvrid news, lots of things going on right now. But, again, I call to wish you many congratulations and congratulations on 100 years in radio.
People to see, places to go, things to do, yeah. Yeah, you do. Well, thank you, President Putin. I really appreciate you calling. I really appreciate it a lot.
That's
thank
it.
You very much.
Yes.
We'll talk to you soon,
yep.
Okay?
До свидания.
Yeah, yes. Bye-bye. Oh, that doesn't happen every day. That's Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. He's calling in. Holy shit. That's pretty cool. You know, we interviewed him once. And, we're going to post, I should have this up by Monday for sure, if not sooner, next Monday. We're posting, we put together a little highlight reel, 10 minutes from the show of our first 100 shows, and he's on it. So, and you have to watch it because he's talking about his lunchbox. That's what I was referring to there. So I'm not going to blow the joke, but it was pretty funny. Yeah, he's pretty good. All right, so where was I here? I was talking about the people who are watching, who are going to Joe Biden's rallies. Now, this didn't change after he became president. I'm just going to go through this. People forget this, that supposedly, this is a supposed reason, it's bullshit, that because of COVID, they didn't let anybody into his inauguration. But the fact is, and this is not me talking, this is the New York Times. It was buried in the Times, but it was in there. That 2 weeks before the inaugural, they only gotten 1,600 requests for tickets. And you can get a maximum of 4 tickets for every request. That's less than 8,000 people. And I don't want to get into this pissy match about who drew more people, Trump or Obama. You know, I thought that was stupid. Trump should have never even brought that up. But the fact is they each drew at least 100,000 people, each minimum, 100,000 people. And here they had tickets, 8,000 tickets to see Biden. And since then, I mean, this is still going on. If you've been watching these supposed quote-unquote campaign stops Biden's been doing the last few weeks, he doesn't get more than 50 people at every one. He's a president of the United States. And I think they try to make it look like that these people are invited. I don't think they are. I do know when he's done public speeches in the past, like at Ohio State University, about 35 people showed up. You know, he did one public event in Lancaster, Louisiana in October of 21, the first year of his presidency, where literally nobody showed up. Nobody showed up to see the president of the United States. So I do not buy the fact that he got 81 million votes. I just don't. But the reason I'm bringing that up because I don't have any proof that the election was cheated. I don't, and I admit it. You know, this is all conjecture on my part. So that's my evidence. I have evidence, but I have no proof, right? So you look at the guy who's talking on MSNBC today. I don't know his name, just a fucking moron. And he's saying, well, this is an obvious falsehood that Joe Biden is coordinating. No. It's not obvious. And if you have any evidence, you should let us know. And I bet you don't. That's the reason you don't bring it up. You don't have any evidence. Trump probably doesn't have any evidence that it happened, but it's obvious conjecture. He's guessing. And like I said, any reasonable person at this point would assume that that's going on based on the ancillary evidence presented, especially Nathan Wade going to the high school. Yeah, going to the White House. But no, no one has any proof. I admit we don't have any proof. I admit it. You know, I'm conjecturing, but this is I'm a commentator. This is what we do here. This is not a news program. I'm not a journalist. I may have worked in one in the past, but that is not my role here. I'm not a journalist, and this is not a news show. I comment on the news, but the guy on MSNBC, he's supposedly a journalist, and it's just bullshit. So they cut Trump off. They cut his speech off because they said they don't want to put lies on their broadcasts, and these are obvious falsehoods. Well, they're not. They're not obvious falsehoods, and if you know there's falsehoods, you should give us some proof. And this is the reason, ladies and germs, this is the reason the trust in the mainstream media in the United States has hit an absolute rock bottom all-time low, and it's still going down. I mean, CNN's ratings have gone down for 3 years for like 35 months straight, and they're still going down. Everyone says, well, they can't go any lower, and they end up going lower. I mean, at this point now, even in prime time, they're not even hitting a half million viewers from what I understand. And I've said this before, in cable television, anything below a million viewers is statistically nothing. So you're wondering, well, how do they stay in business? They stay in business because of carriage fees. The $120 you pay for your cable bill or, in many instances, used to pay, every single channel on your cable system gets a monthly fee from you. Usually it's about, well, I think that last I heard it averages about 17 cents, but it's about $1.50 or $2 for Fox News, which is the single most watched, not just news channel, cable channel, period. And then, I mean, they bested it. ESPN a few years ago. So, and ESPN, believe it or not, gets something like $7 or $8, and that's become a lot of the cable systems are now balking about carrying them. They don't want to give them that much money. That's legacy stuff. Well, you know, CNN still gets about $1.50 per subscriber, and there were about 100 million subscribers in the United States. Now I think it's about 65, but still, you do the math, it's still $100 million a month. You know, so they get $1 billion in cable and carriage fees before they do anything. In other words, they could put an orangutan on TV eating a banana, and they get $1 billion. But this is what this has come to. I mean, they're blatantly lying, and they don't seem to care. And then they're wondering why nobody's watching. This is the part I don't get. How stupid are you? You've completely busted your trust with us, and now you're wondering why nobody's watching. Since when did people in America get so fucking stupid? And so we're going to play the interview with Murray Sabrin, and him and I were talking about this, about the fact that the young people, I'm talking about people out of college now, you know, in their 20s, you know, they do seem to be actually more stupid than previous generations, and they end up, what happens, they go off into these news channels and newspapers, and they're running stuff, and for some reason they think they can do all this shit and people are still going to watch. I don't understand why they think this. I just think they're just, I don't know. I'm an old guy now who wants people to get off my lawn. That's what's going on right here. All right, we're going to play our interview with Murray Sabrin here. This is Murray Sabrin, economist extraordinaire. Joining us from his home in Florida. Oh, Jesus, Murray, you're in Naples, right?
Right, that's in Florida.
Right. Yeah, no, but you used to be in Fort Myers, right?
Right.
Yeah, so I got it straight. Good. That's good. Murray Sabrin, economist extraordinaire. And a hi. we're both on the verge of naps. Now, I won't talk for you, Murray, but for me, it's because I'm 68. So it's like I can take a nap.
Well, I've got a few years on you.
Yeah, but you're still more vibrant than I am. So, Murray, now we put this on our blog this weekend. You gave the Mises memorial lecture at the Austrian Economics Research Conference in Auburn, Alabama this weekend, right?
That's correct. It was,
I got that all correct, right? Yeah.
Absolutely.
And you, the lecture was called The Forgotten Austrian Peter Drucker, correct?
And the welfare state.
Yeah. All right. So now you could watch this, and you can still watch it. I'm going to change the page as soon as we're done here. It's still the, I was right about that, Murray. The live link to YouTube also was a link to the archive. So you can, your lecture's still up there, and I'm going to change the page to reflect the fact it's not live anymore, but it's still running. So if you want to watch this lecture, I suggest you go to our website at gemini.com and go to the blog. It's the top blog, so you can see Murray there. I watched it. So, Murray, can you tell the audience, first of all, who Peter Drucker is? I know, but, you know, if you could tell them.
Peter Drucker was born in Vienna, came to the United States in 1937, and he considered himself foremost a writer and a social ecologist. And basically, he invented the discipline of management when he first did a study of GM, General Motors, and revealed how it could be improved. And that didn't take well with the leadership at General Motors. But nevertheless, he became sort of the go-to management guru in the United States, and he helped dozens and dozens of Fortune 500 companies improve themselves by the techniques that he recommended. And he was a consultant. He was obviously a writer with more than three dozen books under his belt. And then in the last 20 years of his life, he devoted his time to helping nonprofits become better organizations and institutions, because he saw the nonprofit sector as a way to deal with problems that the government tried to solve through the welfare state. And he said, no, these nonprofits are great. They do wonderful work in a whole host of fields. And I did a lot of research, did a lot of reading about Drucker, which I hadn't in the past. And he was really a paradox in a way that he made several statements critical of big government. He said, the wisdom of government can only be found in textbooks. Well, if you take that premise, then you don't want the government involved in anything except what it should be doing, which is protecting our borders, maintaining a police force at the local level, and having courts to adjudicate disputes, and really having sort of the night watchman state, the limited government outlined in the Constitution in terms of Article 1, Section 8, what the federal government should be doing. And instead, he said, we need strong, effective government in some of his writings. And I'm scratching my head and I'm saying, what does strong, effective government mean to Drucker when he criticizes big government? And so that's the area I want to do more research in, because I think he was just a contradiction in the way he approached government. And even though he was in Austria, he was born 28 years later after Ludwig von Mises, the great Austrian school economist. He never really had much interaction with Mises, who criticized socialism, his 1922 book, Socialism, and other writings in the 1920s, and was one of the few economists who predicted the coming of the Great Depression in 1929. Yet Drucker really rarely considers him an important figure in the history of economic thought, which I found very puzzling.
Well, yeah, I heard in your lecture you were talking about this, the fact that in all of his writings, Drucker hardly ever mentioned Mises ever, which is really surprising, you know.
Or Hayek, his foremost student, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1974.
Yeah, those two guys are arguably the biggest economists of the 20th century, really. You know, you throw in Keynes, you get your triumvirate there. And it's amazing, you pointed out that Drucker basically was born almost the same time as Mises, and they both grew up in Austria, and they both ended up leaving around this. Their lives were very parallel, and yet he really didn't even really reference them at all, huh?
Well, that's the amazing thing in all his writings. Like I said, I didn't read every single one of his books, which would be a daunting task, but I've read enough of his work to say, why didn't he realize that the Austrian school economists had it right in terms of how to organize society, which is one of the themes of Drucker's work? How do you best organize society in order for people to fulfill their potential as human beings? And Mises talked about free markets and limited government and having voluntary exchange and making sure prices are able to fluctuate according to supply. In other words, basic common sense economics. And yet Drucker was more concerned with institutions, about how institutions could participate in improving society. And I think that's the major difference between Drucker and the Austrian school. Mises and Hayek and Rothbard and other great Austrian school economists were concerned about how individuals interact and what are the consequences of government intervention in the economy, which was, I think, one of the greatest contributions of the Austrian school economists, especially Rothbard's 1970 book called Power and Market, which is available at the Mises website and in a PDF. Everyone can read it, where Rothbard systematically goes through virtually all government interventions and shows how they are counterproductive to the goals that the interventionists think that they're accomplishing. In other words, justice, fairness, prosperity, things like that, where they don't seem to believe that a laissez-faire economy is the best way to go. And even Drucker criticizes a laissez-faire economy, saying we can't go back to the pre-World War I economy where we basically had laissez-faire economics. He said we're beyond that, but he never explained what specifically should the government be doing. He just talked about strong, effective government, again, which is not exactly a great track record for strong, effective government, in my lifetime at least, where we've had endless wars, inflation, controls, manage economies that don't deliver the goods to the people.
Do you think there's any chance when Drucker was talking about strong government, he was talking about a strong government that didn't do anything? I mean, you know what I mean?
Possible, but as I quoted in some of his writings, he was talking about governments around the world being in supranational organizations, which sounds like an endorsement of the World Economic Forum, which
yes, it does.
The government, that agency that has basically become a de facto world government by issuing edicts on a whole host of issues. And it seems that their agenda is to control the world economy through national governments. And that's not exactly conducive to having people reach their full potential. And that, I think, is the, as Drucker says, is the theme of his work, is how do you create the environment for people to be reaching their maximum potential as human beings. Now, he thought when he wrote about GM that the corporation would be that venue where people could reach their potential as individual workers and give them the status and the vibrancy of being in a community where they work in harmony together to achieve the goals of the organization. And soon Mises realized that with the decline of the corporation, the knowledge worker, which he realized from the 1960 census, was going to be the way the economy will be structured in the future. Well, if that's the case, then you certainly need more autonomy, more freedom, and that implies a limited government, relatively laissez-faire economy. And so I think Drucker missed an opportunity to say, listen, we've tried big government with the Great Society programs. We tried printing money. You know, well, that doesn't work. He lived through the inflation of the post-World War I period in Austria, and he saw what was happening in Germany in 1923 with the crack up of the German economy. And so he was well aware of how governments can destroy economies and the currency and lead to mass poverty. In fact, he was quoted as saying, there are only two things governments do well, print money and war. So if that's your worldview of the nature of government, then the last thing you want to do is have strong government, because it will lead inevitably to inflation, which we've had incessantly since the Federal Reserve was created, and it will lead to endless wars, as we've had since 1914 with World War I. We've had World War I, World War II, and then for the United States, all these undeclared wars since then. So for Drucker to look at the landscape being the social ecology that he was interested in writing about, he should have come to the conclusion, yes, Mises was right, socialism sucks, which, to put it bluntly,
yeah,
collectivism doesn't work. It leads to fascism and totalitarianism. And so therefore, we need to have an environmental structure, an economy, based upon some very fundamental principles that the Austrian school laid out, going back to the 1870s when the Austrian school was founded by Karl Menger. And I'm just really perplexed as to why Drucker really discounted the insights of the Austrian school, especially Mises' 1922 work, Socialism, which Drucker should have read when he was a young man, because he was in school in the 1920s and then as an economics writer in the 1930s. So he should have been familiar with what Mises wrote. And yet I don't see any reference to that in the books that I have read. So therefore, I'm going to go and look at some of his other books and see if he alludes to any of Mises' insights about how society should be structured.
Oh, you know, Murray, what you just said there, that monologue, I got at least a dozen questions. I don't even know what order to put them in. But here, let's just start with this. So somebody at your conference, I think this was a question. I don't think it was actually part of your speech. Were there so many intellectuals gathered in Europe, especially in Austria and Germany in the early part of the 20th century? Now, I have a parallel to this. I went to music school, and I studied the history of Western music with a guy named Franklin Summer, who is a very famous singer at the Metropolitan Opera. And I'm in the class with him, and we're talking about Beethoven. And it's Beethoven's 30 years old in 1800, and he's emerging as a premier composer in Europe. And I asked, just happened to ask Dr. Summers, I said, how many people lived in Vienna in 1800? And he said, you know, that's a really good question. I will get back to you in the next class. And he did. He started the next class off with this, you know, Jim, you asked how many people lived in Vienna in 1800. And the answer was 55,000 people. Mm-hmm. And so the reason I brought that up is because I am wondering, is there some correlation to intellectuals working and living in an environment with a certain number of people, not too many, not too few, Goldilocks zone? Do you buy any of that?
Just from my own observation, without any deep research into the topic, I think what we have here is the cluster effect. In other words, people get together, or people working individually, and they cultivate young people, and those young people then become strike out on their own. And you get, for example, in Austria, you had Karl Menger, whose student was Baum Bawerk, whose student was Mises. And then Mises had this private seminar in the 1920s. A lot of prominent economists developed their economic skills there. And so it is really about, quote, leaders, intellectual giants, who are able to attract young people to them. And we saw this in the United States as well with the Mises Institute and Rothbard and other people from that generation, which is the generation who that was born in the 1920s and 30s, who then attract young people to them. I was one of them reading Rothbard's work starting in the 1970s. And
do you think this breaks down if there's too many people? That the social network that people need for any particular profession literally breaks down if there's too many people? Do you think there's anything to that?
No, I think there are several things at work. Again, this is just a working hypothesis. I don't have any proof.
Right.
But I think you have to remember what the world was like in the 19th century, the 18th century, and even in the early 20th century. There was no internet. There was no distractions. People had to think about issues. They communicated with each other. They wrote letters. They attended seminars. In other words, there was a lot of personal interaction. People were incredibly well-read. When Drucker was in Frankfurt or Hamburg, he went to the library and read works in German, which is his native language, French, and English. I mean, how many young people can do that today?
They
can do English. So you can imagine people learning and reading works in three languages. Plus, they were conversant in Greek literature and other ancient literature. So young people in that period, if they were serious about the world around them, they were curious, and they went to learn about Greek society, Roman society. And that's how you get some of these wonderful books that came out of that period, where people thought about psychology, economics, they thought about history, sociology, even though it may have not been a full discipline at that time, the environment, geography, all these disciplines really came about to a certain extent flowering in the 19th century, because you had these people who were incredibly curious about the world that they lived in and wanted to know what's the best way for human beings to to work with each other harmoniously. They talked about government. What should be the structure of government? Is monarchy a good way? Is a democratic republic a good way to organize ourselves? And so, and what should be the international relations among nations? So they were thinking about a whole host of issues. And again, the 19th century was probably the longest period of world peace in centuries. And from that period came about the flowering of these great individuals. And I think one of the reasons it occurred is since you didn't have these horrific wars like we had in the 20th century, a lot of young people who are going to have fulfilled lives and have breakthroughs in a whole host of subjects were able to live and pursue their dreams.
They literally didn't die.
When Drucker went to Hamburg, he became a senior editor of a newspaper at age 20. How did that come about in 1929? Because he was born in 1909. It came about because the previous generation, many of them were killed during World War I. So there were openings for young men like Drucker, who was too young to fight in World War I.
You were talking about communication. We have today endless communication. It's much easier, and yet I can make an argument here, and this is kind of a loaded question of quality versus quantity. Nowadays people don't have time to think about anything, or at least they don't make the time, you know?
People don't read, Jim. People just don't read anymore. The classic books in whatever discipline they should be learning in school. And I think that's one of the sad realities of American education. It's all about gender and social justice and other topics that don't provide students with basic knowledge of the world they live in. As I mentioned in my talk, one of the greatest gifts I've received was a leather-bound atlas for my bar mitzvah in 1959, and it was just a great way of opening a young person like myself to the rest of the world, to see a map and say, here's these countries, what are these countries all about? So I was a history major and a geography minor with a concentration in social studies education, and I think that gave me the impetus to really study hard as an undergraduate and a graduate student, which eventually led to my college career in 1985, and I think students benefited from that.
So you taught for almost 40 years. You've been retired now for what, four? Am I right?
Yes, 2020, yes.
All right. Do you think the problem is, especially in college, we're not teaching people how to think? I mean, we have a whole generation of young people who seem to convince they're highly educated, but I think they're more, I hate to say it, I think they're morons. You know?
Well, the thing is, all you have to do is put a map, a world map in front of students and ask them the name of the countries that are on the map, or even name the continents that are on the map, and then do a history quiz and see what they know about American history. And teaching the financial history of the United States, I got to see that students had a poor grasp of American, just basic American history. And so when you couple that with finance, they really got to see how our economy evolved over time through the lens of the financial institutions, the financial policies, the financial ups and downs of the economy with the banking panics in the 19th century, and then eventually the creation of the Federal Reserve and what that entailed for the last 110 years. So that course to me was a great interdisciplinary course, because it was history, it was economics, it was finance, it was philosophy, it was public policy. And students got to see exactly what the world was like over the past 200 plus years.
Well, you just touched on something that's my big beef. And this is, Murray, the reason I have you on regularly. And that is, nobody in America knows anything about economics. I think it's disgusting. And especially, we're the most capitalist country in the world. We don't even teach this in high school. It's absurd. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, that's why, Jim, all your listeners should go to the Mises.org website, Mises.org website. And they can get a first-class education for free by reading all the great works of the Austrian economists, by downloading the PDFs there, and start with Rothbard's What Has Government Done for Our Money, and just go through Rothbard books and Mises books and Hazlitt, Economics in One Lesson, the classic published in the year I was born, 1946, which is a great introduction to economics. And it's a classic. It's survived the test of time, as has Rothbard's What Has Government Done to Our Money. And all of Mises' books are just fabulous, because they give people a perspective on how the world works, really works. and it integrates that with public policy of how these policies affect the economy, consumption, production, capital formation, the money supply, the gold standard, and this is why I've been a lifelong learner. I never stop learning. Every time I go to the Mises.org website, I learn more about economics than I have known in the past. And so the writers there are great. They're from all over the world, and they have tremendous insight, and they comment on current events. And so to me, this is heaven, because I've always been curious about the world we live in, and people should take advantage of a website that has so much information, and they can pick and choose they're interested
free.
In.
Almost all of it's free. Yes. It's really amazing. I want to go back to talking about globalism and the World Economic Forum. Now I'm going to run another theory by you. So, if you ask a lot of liberals, they will ask you, why is globalism bad? And here's my answer to that. I'm just curious on your reaction. And that is because it's still the lack of globalism recognizes competition. Countries still compete against each other. If you had one giant, if the world was made out of one giant government, there would be no competition anyway. It would basically just devolve into bullshit. You know, that's my personal feeling. What do you think about that?
Well, if you have one world government, you eliminate individual sovereignty, business sovereignty. The whole point of an economy is that individuals and businesses work together in order to produce goods and services that people want, not from a mandate from Washington or the state capital or the UN or the World Economic Forum. The notion that you can have a top-down economy, which is what the World Economic Forum wants, is that it would be ruinous to freedom and to prosperity. There are some people who have this romantic notion that only if some smart people get together, they can plan the economy. Well, Mises demolished that in 1922 with his socialism book. And everyone should read that. It's not an easy read. It's 900 pages. But he demolishes the whole concept of collectivism. And he should have won a Nobel Prize for that book alone, because when the Soviet Union collapsed, when East Europe was liberated in the late 80s, early 90s, all these left-wingers, especially in the economics profession, concluded that Mises was right in 1922. Well, it took people more than 60 years to realize that, 70 years to realize that. But Mises had the answer in 1922, which just shows you how shallow the intellect is of these people who've gotten Nobel Prizes in economics, who still think democratic socialism is the way to organize ourselves.
Yeah,
globalism, Jim, is another word for collectivism.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. We've been fucking around on Earth with socialism and communism for 100 years now, and it's pretty much proven that it doesn't work. So why do people, I mean, this is a rhetorical question, but why do people keep pushing this? I mean, it does not work. You know, I don't understand.
Well, this is the great mystery, that when I first read the Austrian material back in the early 1970s, mid-1970s, I said, this is just common sense. This is how the world works.
Yes.
People getting together, building a business or building it on their own, and then seeing what people want and need, and then producing it for their needs. And if they're good at doing that, you can make oodles of money, which I've said to my students, all you have to come up with one very good idea in America, you can become incredibly rich. If you come up with a great idea, you can become a billionaire. You really can in America. If you can come up with a product or a service that people want, well, look at Amazon, what Jeff Bezos did with Amazon, with Walmart, Sam Walton and Walmart, with Bill Gates and Microsoft, Steve Jobs and Apple, now with NVIDIA, the company's worth $2 trillion. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So again, if you have focus on something that will make people's lives better, the sky's the limit in America.
You talked in your speech, you referenced LBJ's Great Economy. And I mean, I have
That's
always...
Great Society.
Yeah, Great Society. Excuse me. Yeah, you're right. You're right about the fact that like you, well, at least you inferred this. I don't know if you actually, you didn't actually say it. But I basically regard that whole thing as one gigantic failure.
No question about it. In fact, there's a chart that the Heritage Foundation put out years ago showing that the poverty rate was declining after World War II because of the relatively free economy that we had with no Social Security taxes, no Medicare taxes. The economy was booming from a wartime economy to a peaceful economy, and the poverty rate kept on declining from 30-40% after World War II down to about 12-14% in 65. Then when the Great Society programs hit, after that, the poverty rate basically goes sideways. And so it demonstrated with all the trillions of dollars spent by the federal government on, quote, curing poverty, poverty has won because the poverty rate really hasn't gone down. But the beauty about our economy, Jim, even low-income people have cell phones and internet service and laptops and computers and what have you, because the companies that make those products in real dollars, the price has been going down tremendously over the last 30-40 years. So that makes these products available for mass consumption.
So, Murray, I was talking about this on my show a few days ago. I went into a Micro Center to buy some stuff a few days ago. I don't know if you're familiar with the Blue Company, BLU. They make really cheap Android cell phones. Mm-hmm. You can get an Android cell phone. Now, okay, it's not the fastest thing on the planet, but it works for $70.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy, you know? I mean, and you're talking about, like, competition and manufacturing goods. I mean, competition, I mean, we have a $70 cell phone because of competition. Yeah. Oh, I got to ask you, this is completely off topic, but I think it's really important. What do you think about this antitrust thing with Apple? I got to admit, I kind of don't buy it, but go ahead.
No, antitrust is probably, again, the Austrians have been right on top of this subject for decades, showing that antitrust doesn't make any sense because the whole purpose of a company, the whole goal of a company is to make products available to consumers or services at cheaper and cheaper prices. So companies should be able to merge because that's a voluntary exchange. No one's putting a gun to anyone's head to merge. And so the notion of what price companies should charge, the government knows what the best price is. No, the best price is what consumers are willing to pay for a product or service, not what the government thinks should be the price of a product or service. And so the whole notion of antitrust has been demolished by Rothbard in his book, Power and Market, Dom Armentano, an economist who's written a great book on the myth of antitrust. I mean, these books are out there. The literature is out there. The arguments against antitrust have been out there for decades, but the federal government keeps on insisting that antitrust is an important weapon to help consumers when the opposite is true, because when the government applies antitrust, prices tend to go up instead of going down.
All right, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. How do you address monopoly? I mean, right now, basically the legal definition of monopoly is any company that has more than 80% of the market, more or less.
Well, the historical definition of a monopoly, Jim, is a grant to a company for a geographical exclusion. In other words, cable companies were monopolies at one time because there was only one cable company. Now you have satellite, dish, and whatever.
Right.
Historically, a monopoly meant a grant from the crown, from the king, to exclude other companies. In a free market, no one's excluded. If you have a better product than Apple, go for it. If you have a better product than Amazon or a service than Amazon, go for it. And there are companies that compete with Amazon. There are companies that compete with Apple. Big size is not a determinant of monopoly power, because a monopoly means the government's excluding somebody from entering the marketplace. I mean,
yes. In this current scenario, I mean, my problem with the Apple thing is that Apple doesn't even have 50% of the cell phone market. They don't even have half of it. So how do you charge them with antitrust? It doesn't make any sense to me at all, even under the current rules.
Well, consumers are voting with their dollars. They want Apple instead of other products that are out there. So again, do I want to pay as much as I do for Apple products or any other product? No. I would like to buy a car for $10,000, but the cars that I want or the SUVs that I want are probably $40,000, $50,000. But that's the marketplace. The marketplace is the ultimate determinant of value, where consumers say, hey, I'm willing to pay this amount for this product. And I gave that example when I in Spain in 1972, when I was looking to buy a jacket and a street vendor, and she told me it was more expensive in the store where it was air conditioned. I said, well, I'm not in the store and the sun is beating down on me.
That's right.
And I said, my subjective value is this. Your your jacket should be a lot cheaper than the store because I'm buying it with all the without any of the benefits of being in a nice, cool, air-conditioned store.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to give you another rhetorical question here. We were talking about globalism. One of the things about it seems to me that liberals have a really hard time buying the concept of the invisible hand and of Adam Smith's. And the reason is because, yes, and on the surface, it doesn't make any sense. You think this wouldn't work. I mean, basically, you're talking about just you unleash people, and people seem to self-organize and just figure shit out. And they do. And it's been proven time and time again. So, you know, a liberal will say, no, we need somebody to actually organize this, and we don't.
Well, this is the arrogance of the political class and economists who spout these nonsense that you need top-down approaches to the economy, by the economy. And so Drucker is in that belief also when he says we need the government as the orchestra leader instead of the doer. In other words, he doesn't want government to provide the services. He wants government to help pay for some of these services. When I think as a libertarian that we should have people raise money in nonprofits the old-fashioned way, voluntarily. And I propose that all nonprofits should not get any taxpayer money, which is spent through the government, that all nonprofits should be financially independent and let people decide which nonprofits should survive and thrive and which ones should fall by the wayside, like companies have done over the past millennia.
Yeah. So you were talking about in your – and I think this was an answer to a question. I can't remember. You were talking about in your speech about the difference between NGOs and what's called GONGOs. Can you tell the public or our viewers what GONGOs are?
That was government-supported organizations. I don't remember the acronym for that.
It's actually – hold on a second. I wrote it down here. It's government-organized non-governmental organizations.
Yeah.
It sounds like an oxymoron.
A lot of the problems with these NGOs is that they are directed by government. They get money from the government, which means the taxpayer. And again, I've been preaching financial independence for decades, and we need to have all institutions financially independent, the public, the schools, the universities, the nonprofits. They should not receive any taxpayer dollars, which would reduce the size of government dramatically. Of course, we have to reduce taxes so people will have more money to help pay for these organizations that they think are worthwhile. In other words, the whole notion of individual sovereignty is that people use their money for consumption, for saving and investment, and for charitable contributions. That is the way you have a free society, a prosperous society, and you have less political polarization, which we have on steroids today.
For years, I've been bitching and moaning about the fact that NPR gets money from the government. I don't understand why they do. I mean, I don't have any trouble with them existing. Same with Planned Parenthood. We can talk about their mission. That's a completely different subject. But I have no idea why the government actually gives them money. I just don't understand
it. This is the nexus between the nonprofits, some nonprofits, a lot of nonprofits, and the government. If they get money from the government, of course, these people will be supportive of whoever proposes the most grants to these organizations.
Yeah, no shit, right. Yeah.
So there's a huge conflict of interest, to say the least. Besides, it's immoral to take money from people who don't support these organizations and then give it to them through their taxes.
Yeah. Now, you touched on this, and this is worth bringing up. As a matter of fact, we could even end with this. Fox Business today announced the fact that Americans are adding $16 billion a day to the national debt. That's crazy shit, Murray.
Yeah, there's a front page article in the Wall Street Journal today about the debt. And these numbers are going to go off the charts the next several years because there's no desire in Washington to cut spending. And when you don't cut spending and when you increase spending and you don't raise the tax revenue to pay for it, the debt's going to explode, especially in so-called good times. And now what happens if the next recession where the economy falls off the cliff and expenditures go up and tax revenue goes down? We may see $4-5 trillion deficits in the future, which would be horrific because foreigners buy that debt. And if they don't, and the Federal Reserve steps in by monetizing debt, in other words, buying up the debt with new money, then we're off to the races with inflation.
No shit. I mean, that's in some ways, that's already happening. I do think I want to point this out to the viewers, though. the difference between debt and deficit. Deficit is the annual shortfall of government spending. Debt is the accumulated, correct?
Yep. And it's going to just get bigger and bigger as time goes on. In fact, I think we may see a number in the future which will blow people's minds as to the total national debt of the federal government.
Yeah, but what happens if the government has to default?
Well, the thing is, the interest expense, the annual interest expense is approaching $1 trillion, which is so mind-boggling.
Yes, it
is. If interest rates stay at these levels or even go higher in the future, what that does will crowd out all other spending in the budget, and then the federal policymakers will have to make a decision. Do they raise taxes substantially to cover the deficit, or do they cut spending, which of course they should be doing? But as Drucker pointed out, we live in a world of entitlements, that everyone thinks they're entitled to money from Washington, D.C., or virtually everyone, except libertarians and free market people, that we have a real cultural problem, psychological problem. People don't want to be self-sustaining. They don't want to be financially independent. And that's what I think is the issue that's facing the country that no one wants to talk about in Washington, D.C. How do you create a society of financially independent adults?
Do you think at this point anyone or anything could reverse this?
That's the $64,000 question. That's what I do with what I do, namely write on my Substack column, attend these conferences, give talks, and try to reach out to as many people as possible. But it's so embedded, the whole psychology. Even Republicans say we should have a social safety net, which means more government spending for welfare expenditures, including corporate welfare, I might add. When people think of welfare, they think of the young mother with 2-3 kids without a husband.
Yes,
but
right.
And of course, Social Security and Medicare are also welfare programs, which I pointed out in my talk. We can have another discussion on that some other time. But corporate welfare is embedded in our budget, federal budget, between farm subsidies and grants to corporations. That should all disappear.
That's absurd, right?
Yeah, I mean, these institutions, businesses should make it or not make it on their own and make sure that they're efficient so they can make a profit instead of incurring losses. And when they do get losses, sometimes the government steps in and subsidizes them with solar energy and Green New Deal and all the other things that the Biden administration has pushed down our throats.
Murray, I could talk to you for another hour, but I'm going to cut this short. I hope you don't mind.
I don't mind at all, Jim.
We're gonna put links up to the Mises Institute and your Substack column and all that stuff. And also, I'm going to change the, like I said to viewers, we're going to change the blog post to reflect the fact that that's now the archive of your speech. We can still watch it. I watched it on archive. So, it was great. You know,
thanks so much. I appreciate it.
I told you this before. I'm going to say it again. You're doing a service to the American public. People need to hear this shit. Not shit. People need to hear this stuff. That's my talk, Murray. I'm terrible. I should be on a boat somewhere. Anyway, you take care of yourself, all right?
Thanks so much, Jim. Appreciate it. Congratulations on your 100th show.
Hey, thank you. And we're going to have you on very soon again. I'm looking forward to it. Okay?
Thanks so much.
You take care.
Take care.
That's Murray Sabrin, economist extraordinaire. He's the professor emeritus at Ramaco College in New Jersey of economics. We have a caller here. Caller, are you still there? Hello?
Yeah,
hello?
I wanted to jump in on that. Yeah. Hi, can you hear me?
Hi, I'm sorry I put you on hold so long. That was a pre-recorded interview, so I couldn't interrupt it. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
It's okay. It's okay. I want to jump in and talk about capitalism. I kind of liked what he said about capitalism, but from what I've been seeing recently, I've been seeing a lot of flaws that have been coming out of capitalism, and that's the fact that a lot of companies are actually, or corporations, a lot of people end up winning. Once these people start building up their product or their business services, whatever, they become a bigger company and eventually reach a corporation level. And once they reach that level, I'm starting to see these corporations start entering into the government and paying off politicians or government officials to write rules and regulations that allow them to succeed and block other businesses from competing with them. And I think that's the big problem of capitalism these days. So basically what I'm trying to say is I don't think capitalism is a perfect system because of things like that.
I totally agree with you. It's highly imperfect. The only thing is, the terrible thing, if you ask me, is that even considering all that stuff, it's still better than communism and socialism, because that seems to lead to totalitarianism, because it hasn't every time it's ever been tried. But you're absolutely right. It's a highly imperfect system. I mean, and right now it appears that nobody wants to pass any laws to correct any of this shit, you know? And no, I'm totally with you on this. You're right. I don't know any better way to put it. I mean, yes, it's extremely flawed, you know?
This is the problem with me and conservative thinking sometimes. I think a lot of conservatives take words too literal, like the word socialism. To them, I think a lot of conservatives equate the word socialism to like devil or evil or something, but they don't realize that that's just a word, right? Here in America, we have socialist policies here in America too, like the fire department, the police department. Those are socialist systems in place. So like the fire department is not a company. They're not selling anything. It's the people's taxes that are keeping them employed. So fire departments that are in a rich community tend to be bigger, have better products, whereas a fire department in a low income where the taxes is not so great, those fire departments tend to be less manned, dirty, trash, and they have older equipment like fire trucks and stuff like that. But it's based off of people's donations in a way, you know, but it's the taxes, but it's based off people's donations or whatever you could call that. To support these companies. So the United States is what I'm trying to say is it has socialist policies in place. Don't forget.
Yes, I would agree with that too. The thing is, if you look at the specific example you just gave, it would be fairly easy for a state, for example, because most fire departments, and let's use your example, it's a good one. Most fire departments are local, of course. You know, and they're based around townships or cities, but you could set up a system where that the state would pool the money that everyone was being charged for their fire department and then distribute it more or less equally. You could do that, you know, but nobody does, you know. I don't know why. It sounds like a good idea, you know. The only thing you'd have to take into account is really it wouldn't be so much distribution of wealth based on people are living. Where they're living, and literally you'd have to redistribute the funds depending on how many fires there were. I mean, that's really how you'd have to do it. But I suppose, okay, if you want to call that socialism, yeah, I guess that's a socialist idea, you know?
Yeah. Like I said, a lot of conservatives I'm just going to use that term, conservatives. A lot of conservatives hear the word socialist and they automatically think, no, we cannot have that because the word is bad. The word is bad, not the underlining element of it. The public schools are also a socialist system as well. Okay. Public schools here in the United States are socialist systems. Now, we have to find a combination of the two, the capitalist system that we have integrated in a way with the socialist system. And to get that to work properly, we have to ignore the words, the terminology. Yeah. We have to overlook the words and actually see the implementation, the actual concept of what these things do. And I think that's the problem. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say I agree with you on that, too. I do. I do want to point something out, though, as far as your example about education. I think that's a perfect example of how socialism fails, because I don't know about you, but I would conclude right now that after, let's say, 70 or 80 years of public education in the United States, it's now failing, you know, basically. But I think that's literally because of the socialist aspect of it. But you know, I don't know. You might not agree.
No, I kind of agree with you. How do I break this down? Well, I think that whoever is in control, like the last Murray or whatever you had on your show earlier on that talk, he talked about NGOs, non-government organizations. And I think that if there's an elite group that is telling these public schools what to teach, these NGO groups telling them, hey, we need them to teach this and that. We need them to not think so much, like how you were saying that, like, students don't think. I think that that public school mentality goes into college where they're not teaching these people to think. They're teaching them how to work.
I agree.
And to be an employee and not to be individual thinking. I mean, if you think of all the people that have changed our society, these people, the majority of them have all dropped out of school. I mean, Einstein, for example.
That's true.
You know, Bill, yeah. Yeah, Bill Gates.
Steve Jobs. Yeah. All these people are college dropouts.
Yeah. The majority of people I'm not at this level thinking, but I would imagine this is why the elite students, the smart ones, the real smart ones that want to go to Ivy League schools, they don't want to go there because of the teachers. They want to go there to meet other smart people like them. And they learn from each other. It's not the teachers. It's them meeting with other people like them. And so if you're going to say, if you're going to say that school is a bad system, in terms of what they're being taught, then that might be true. More likely that's true. But if that system is not in place, then a lot of people would not get an education, period, whether it's a good education or a bad. You know what I mean?
I totally agree with you on that, too. We can't eliminate it because, that's even worse than a bad system is still better than no system. I totally agree with you on that. I do.
That's right. But that's right.
We need to fix this somehow, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I would think that the way to fix it would be to, like, what we're doing is people bring up the topic. And that's what I like about America. What makes this country great is people talk about it. And eventually the words get heard. For example, during the 90s and 80s, I was listening to during the late 90s, early 2000s, I was listening to Alex Jones' show. And I remember him talking about NGOs, you know, no one heard about this type of stuff at that time. It was around, but no one really cared about this. And Alex Jones kept talking about how the government was pushing bad food on people, these non-NGO foods that were genetically modified to kill us and all this type of stuff. And he kept talking about how bad it is. Now, fast forward to 2024, I mean, supermarkets now have an organic section. Someone is listening. Yeah, someone is listening. And we have labels now to indicate that which product has more of an genetically modified foods in it. So that's what makes this country great. The more we talk about it, the more we complain about it, eventually someone listens. And the capitalism part of this country is the companies that are listening will give a product to cater to the people that want that product. Does that make sense? I don't know if I'm organizing it properly. Yeah.
No. You're communicating very well. Go ahead.
Hopefully that system still stays in place where in terms of the capitalists, where corporations listen and give us a selection for our preference. But when the problem that I originally started this talk with you about is there's corporations right now that are so powerful that they eliminate the competition. Say, for example, I want non-GMO foods, but the companies that are in power or that are super powerful, they have so much money that they they pay off politicians to write laws and legislations that block companies from having organic foods hit the market because that will bring them down. And we see this all the time. For example, the vape industry, they were being attacked so bad by the cigarette industry themselves. I mean, they were slandered. They were saying that vaping was causing all kinds of health issues. They were saying that the battery exploded. During the first years of the vape industry, the cigarette industry literally kept destroying them, kept trying to stop them from rising up. But luckily, here in America, the capitalism took over and people broke down the facts. We were allowed to hear the facts of why vaping is better than smoking. For example, it doesn't have the thousands of chemicals that a cigarette does. And in terms of the batteries, it was people experimenting on the batteries. It wasn't the actual batteries itself. It was people making the batteries bigger. And the chemicals that were making people sick was from added vitamin, like vitamin E, that they were adding into the illegal liquids that people were using at the time, like marijuana vapes and things like that.
Yeah.
So you
touched on, I think, the real crux of this whole thing, and that is politicians getting paid off. So now, this is not a loaded question, because I got to admit, I personally do not have a solution for this. How do you stop this? I don't know.
And that's the big problem. We have to limit these big corporations. We have to limit them. I don't think Apple is doing anything nefarious, right? I don't think they're doing anything nefarious. I just think they're brainwashing their people that buy their products, but I don't think they're doing things nefariously. But the cigarette industry, the sugar industry, these companies are doing things nefariously to pay off these politicians. So I actually did come up with a solution for this, and I don't know if it can work. But I think we need a police system like they have an FBI, CIA that monitor the people. I think we need a police system to monitor the politicians more carefully. Like the America has three branches. But that's it. Yeah. They're supposed to watch over one another, but there's not individual groups that watch them more carefully in depth. And I think we should have organizations like that to monitor these politicians more carefully, because they're corrupt as hell.
I've thought of that too. So the thing is, what you're proposing, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, so tell me if I'm wrong about this. I think what you're proposing is we basically need some sort of citizen board. So these are not politicians, and they're not people who are not being paid to basically oversee payments to congressmen and that sort of thing. And it'd have to be really insulated, because you'd have to make certain that these people didn't get paid, you know? Also, the thing is, and you might even have to assign citizens to this panel almost at random. Because, you know, how would you, you didn't know, then you'd have the problem keeping corruption out of that. You know what I mean?
That's correct. It's a tough thing to do.
It could be done. I think it might fail, but, you know, I don't know. I think it's worth trying. I thought of this too. You know, we need somebody to oversee the politicians, but the problem is, do those people also become politicians? You know, that's the problem. I don't know.
Well, that's a tough question. That's a really tough question. There are people here in America that do. There's a group of people here in America, unlike most countries, there's a group of people here in America that do things out of passion. For example, graffiti artists. They're not getting paid to do their graffiti on trains. Yeah. They're risking their lives. A lot of these people died to do this, and they spend hundreds of dollars each time they do. I don't know if you know, if you bought a spray paint can, it's about $5 to $10 each can that they use. That, and they're using 10s and 20 cans to make their piece. And I use them as an example. There's a group of people here in America that just do things out of love for it. And so
that's true.
there are people here in America that want to do good. So we just have to find those people. Not all politicians are bad. There are
right.
That's
no. No, you're right about that. Not all politicians are bad. No.
Yeah. But the main thing here is if we don't attempt to do something, it will never get. That's the number
right.
one thing, you know.
And that see, that's where I'm in total agreement with you on here. And that is, this might be worth trying because something needs to be tried. You know, yeah. Because
right.
the thing
that's
is, right. you know, you don't find out until you actually do it.
That's right. Here in New York, we have a group of organizations now that are overlooking the police department here in New York.
Are you in New York City?
No, I'm in upstate New York, upstate New York area.
Right.
Yeah, New York City is another issue in itself. They're getting,
yes,
it's
it
another
That's true.
Wild.
Yeah.
Yeah, but here in upstate New York, we are having organizations that are funded by the government here, by the mayors and lawyers, the mayors and governors, to pay, they're giving money to these organizations to overlook the police, to make sure that these police officers are in check. And these organizations are looking over individual police officers, like on a regular. And that's
yeah.
what we need. For the longest time, these police officers were just protecting one another. You know, if they
yeah.
beat up somebody, for example, or they did something bad, their colleagues would protect them. But now there's organizations that are overlooking these people. And can they be paid off? Yeah, maybe, but I don't think so. I think that these groups of people really do care for their community, and they're really – taking their job seriously. And I want to see that input. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
I want to see that type of stuff that overlooking the politicians as well.
Yeah, so in a country of 330 million people, you're not going to find it. Even though the percentage of these people, like you were saying, who would work out of passion and nothing else is going to be percentageably low. You would have no trouble finding enough people to do it. You wouldn't. That would not be a problem.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I agree with that 100%. Yeah, it's very possible. But even if we don't know for sure, we would never know if it's not done. That's
true.
That's 100%
right.
fact.
Well, all right.
So,
I'm going to run one more thing by here too, and that is, I think one of the problems with our system is we don't try enough stuff. You know, people aren't.
That's
the
right.
Government, Congress is not willing to just try stuff. They won't do it. You know, they think that once you do something, it's like forever. And that bothers me too.
That's right. That's right. But I like Trump a lot. I like Trump a lot. But I find that conservative mentality is questionable these days. The more that I talk to a conservative, I start to realize they don't want to see progressive ideology, like changes. They don't
right.
want to see change. They want everything to be how it was. Like, for example, the Second Amendment, right? It says that we should all have a gun. We should all be allowed to have a gun. I have a gun, but I don't think everyone should have a gun. I see too many psychopaths to know that, hey, not everyone should have a gun. But a lot of these conservatives say that, you know, it doesn't matter how many times someone goes to jail. If they get out of jail, they should still have that right, their Second Amendment right to own a gun again. And that's
yeah.
some scary stuff to me, you know.
Let me run this by you. I think part of the problem is conservatives are really, I'm going to say, for lack of a better term, you're talking about the old style conservatives, but you are. I mean, they exist for sure. But I think they're afraid of the slippery slope phenomena. In other words, they think that if they don't pin this right to the wall and that everybody have a gun, sooner or later, all guns are going to be taken away. I think that. So in other words, it's, to them, it's an either or scenario. And of course, in real life, that's stupid. You know, it is. But I think this is, and I'm not trying to justify the way they think, but this, I think this is the reason they think that way.
Yeah, yeah, I would have to agree, because it makes no sense why anyone would say something like that, you know, how many times somebody commits a crime, they should be allowed to own a gun. Blind people should be allowed to own a gun. I hear the most ridiculous things from out of this group, and that must be why they believe that, like what you said. They feel that if you don't give these people guns, eventually all their gun rights are going to be taken away. And I find that kind of ridiculous, but in a way, it might be true too.
I'm not, you know, well, yeah, first of all, especially lately, you know, the people are right now the conservatives are using the example of gay marriage, the fact that, you know, so the gay community wanted marriage and they got marriage and everyone's thinking, okay, well, fine. You know, most people don't have a problem with this. Some people still do, but most people don't. And they're thinking, okay, fine. And now we end up with this transgender stuff with a lot of people, especially when it comes to sports, thinks is nuts. And everyone's saying, well, how, you know, and they are looking at that as a slippery slope. It was like, okay, we said fine to gay marriage, and now we got this. And it's like, and, you know, this is, and I mean, you know, there's I think to me, it gets back to what you just kind of said it, is that there's a common sense approach to this. I mean, I'll tell you, I don't want mentally ill people to have guns, and I don't want criminals to have guns either. You know, I don't. So, but, you know, people think, well, if I make this concession, the whole thing's going to blow up. And right now I could say there's some evidence that that's actually true. So it's really scary. I don't know. I don't know if you agree with me or, you know what, but that's kind of the way I see it.
I agree with you. I think I agree with you. I think we should have guns. We should be allowed to own guns. But I like a car. For us to own a car, we need to go through rigorous training, right? We have to have a road test, and we have to have a driver's license test. Not just that, we have to register the car, make sure that the car is in our name, that it's not stolen in case it gets into an accident, someone gets hurt. Here in America, we have to have insurance on the car. We have to have inspections. Why don't we keep that type of mentality towards guns as well? For someone to own a gun, you know, they should go through that type of training as well, like training and
I gotta tell you, a cousin of mine was an officer on the Los Angeles Police Department. And he was always talking about this. He said, you should get a gun. He's talking to me, but he's talking to anybody. He said, you should get a gun, but God in heaven, go get, you know, he said, I will arrange for you to get some training at a gun club. You know, I mean, he was adamant about this. That anybody who owns a gun should be trained to use it. You know, and I don't know if you know the statistics. People who own guns are much, much more likely to get shot by other people. And it's usually because they don't know when to pull the gun out. That's usually the way that happens, you know? So, no, I mean, no, what you're saying is completely, I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying. I mean, yeah, if you buy a gun, you should be, along with the purchase, you should be forced to get gun training. You should, you know? I don't see any problem with this at all. Now, the thing is, I'm not pretending, I know in some states this is true. You know, there's a lot of the stuff we're talking about, but it varies from state to state too. So I don't pretend to know a lot about this. I mean, you listen to Dana Lash. I mean, she's an expert, you know, but I'm not. So, you know, I don't know, but generally I kind of agree with what you're talking about.
Yeah. I think shotguns or rifles, I think all states do the same thing. Like anyone could just buy one of these guns, like buy a rifle or a shotgun in any state. I think every state, it's easier to buy those guns than a handgun. Handguns, yes, because you can conceal them, they go through a more rigorous background checks, and you have to prove that all type of things. And that's okay with me. That's okay with me. But the fact that these conservatives are saying that that we shouldn't have to go through all this. I talked to a conservative where they wanted it where gas stations could sell guns. for like cheap prices, like $20. And anyone could go in there and buy one. Like a 14-year-old kid can go in there and buy a gun. And that's ridiculous to me, that type of thinking. But that's the a lot of these do I call them radical conservatives? There are these
you can call them radical conservatives because here's the analogy I want to make to that. To me, what you're saying, that's just as ridiculous as saying you can abort a baby 2 days before it's going to be born. I mean, those are to me those are. I do not want people to buy guns at gas stations. I don't, and I do not want people to abort babies on the, in the ninth month. I don't want that either. I look at both of those things as radical ideas, and I think the majority of the public does too.
Yeah, that's right.
I think the majority of the public agrees with you on this. You know, and the thing is, and I don't know if you heard the first block of the show, but. One of the problems, and I get back to this constantly, is our media doesn't report things correctly. If you listen to the mainstream media, you will get the idea that everybody is basically like a fucking radical. And that's just not true. The vast majority of the people in this country are, I will say for lack of a better term, reasonable. I don't think anybody of any reasonable nature wants people to buy guns at gas stations. I don't think that, you know? That should not be legal. It just shouldn't. But on the other hand, you're absolutely right. I do think, you know, if you, unless you're mentally ill or you're criminal, you should be able to buy a gun and your legal age, of course, you know. So, you know, it's like this is a problem in this country. We have people speaking, throwing out completely unrealistic ideas, and yet they want to be taken seriously. And I'm tired of it. I just am.
Yeah. So
last word to you.
And I agree with you on that. Yeah. So I agree with you on that. The problem that I see, and it I hate to say this type of stuff, but it goes back to Trump. A lot of these people that are I don't think Trump is a racist. I'm 100% sure Trump is not a racist. From what I've studied on Trump and me living in New York, like hearing about Trump, I don't think he's a racist at all. But my problem is it seems like all these racist groups are supporting Trump. And for me to like vote for Trump, it feels like I'm empowering them. And now these groups that are these racist groups, a lot of them believe in what I told you about like gun policy. They want that type of stuff. And it's hard for me to support a good president when a lot of bad people are supporting him. Does that make sense, what I just said?
Yes, it does. You have to forgive me. I got to cut you off because in 2 minutes our connection is going to fail.
Okay.
So I got to wrap the show up. We only have 2 hours here. So, and I don't mind you. I'm really glad you called. This is fantastic. This has been an amazing conversation. Thank you. Please call again. I'm sorry I have to do this, but I do. So.
Okay. Talk to you again. Thank you for having me on your show. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, call in again. Please appreciate it. I didn't get that guy's name from upstate New York. Yeah, we have two minutes left here before our connect. There you go. That's the sexy British lady. So tomorrow, Dr. Bruce Rapinoe, he's a neuroscientist, and he's a guy who says he's been abducted by aliens. So we're talking to him tomorrow. I want to thank everybody for calling in tonight. I want to thank Murray Sabrin. Our 100th show was highly successful, and it was very long. This is only the second show we've done that's gone 2 hours. So I hope you enjoyed it. So she wants to end this. I don't know what her problem is. Here we go. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks, everybody.